You are listening to a special pre-recorded episode of the Four Persons Show. Though we will not be taking live calls tonight, we want to answer any questions or comments you may have. Drop us a line at email at thefourpersons.com.
Welcome to The Tangled Knot with Deb Rojas. With the help of our Heavenly Mother Mary, undoer of knots, Deb seeks to help us untangle the knots we find, and often cause, in our own lives. Deborah Rojas, MS, is a psychotherapist and mental health counselor at Integrity Counseling Services. A graduate of Divine Mercy University, Deborah utilizes a variety of approaches within a Catholic Christian framework, depending on the needs of the client. These approaches include cognitive behavioral therapy, internal family systems, emotion-focused therapy, forgiveness therapy, person-centered therapy, gestalt techniques, and narrative therapy. She specializes in women's issues, relationship trauma, spiritual trauma, physical and sexual trauma, anxiety and depression, and grief and loss. She also works with priests, pastors, and seminarians, drawing from her background of over 20 years of working in both Protestant and Catholic churches. For more information about Deb and Integrity Counseling, please visit them at integritycounselingpa.com. Once again, the address is integritycounselingpa.com. Now, ladies and gentlemen, Deb Rojas.
Hello and welcome to The Tangled Knot. I am Deb Rojas, your host. This is a show where we get together and we talk about the many different messes and tangles and issues of life and seek to work them out in ways that are ordered, that help us to love God better, to love each other better, and to understand and love ourselves properly. And a lot of times on the show, we talk about things from a counseling perspective, as I am a counselor with Integrity Restored. But tonight, I want to put on a different hat and talk about liturgy and worship, evangelism, and with a friend of mine who is a liturgist in the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. James, welcome to the show.
Hello, everybody.
So James Griffin is here tonight joining us with his organization, the Durandus Institute, and we'll hear about that. We'll hear about the Ordinariate. We'll hear about the installation of Father Sam Keyes at St. John the Baptist in Bridgeport, Pennsylvania, the Ordinariate Parish there. And, the unique thing about the Ordinariate is that it's full of converts. And I'm a convert. I celebrated 10 years last week, actually, July 27th. James, how long have you been Catholic?
I've been Catholic since 2005. So that would be
18 years. Mm-hmm. So getting close to 20.
Yeah.
How old were you when you came into the church?
I was 18 years old. I was in my last year of high school. I was received as a Catholic about... I would say a month and 3 weeks after my 18th birthday.
Wow. So was that during the Easter season or no?
No, that was Christmas Eve, where I received all three of the sacraments of initiation at the same time, back in my hometown of San Antonio, Texas, at the Church of Our Lady of the Atonement.
So for our listeners who are most used to having people received into the church when they're baptized and confirmed and all on Easter Vigil, can you explain how it's possible for that to happen outside of the Easter season?
Yes. Well, for most people who come into the Catholic faith, they are asked to undergo a period of catechesis and preparation leading up to the Easter Vigil. And that is, yes, liturgically, that is the optimal time if one is going to receive the sacrament of baptism as an adult. Mm-hmm. However, in my particular case, when I approached the Church of Our Lady of the Atonement, which, by the way, is the first of the so-called Anglican use pastoral provision parishes within the Catholic Church. This is a precursor to the Ordinariate, which I'm sure you'll ask me about in a second. But very briefly, I will explain that this is this was an initiative under Pope St. John Paul II in 1983, when he authorized the first communities for former Anglicans and other Protestants to come into the full communion of the Catholic Church while retaining certain aspects of their worship traditions and allowing their married former Anglican priests to be ordained as Catholic priests. But there was no jurisdiction like the Ordinary to tie these all together. So these parishes were under the local diocese. So Our Lady of the Atonement was...
They operated like a personal parish then?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. That is exactly the term for Our Lady of the Atonement at that time.
So what made Our Lady of the Atonement attractive to you as an 18-year-old? And how did that factor into your conversion?
My father was an Episcopalian, and my mother is still a Seventh-day Adventist. And when I was growing up, I was familiar with both traditions, but I really spent most of my upbringing under the Seventh-day Adventist Church. However, the Adventist Church, like many Protestant denominations, does not practice infant baptism. And so when I was getting older, I was asked to receive baptism in the Adventist Church. But before I decided to do that, I wanted to hold off for a bit so that I could I could study the Christian faith and evaluate other churches for myself. And so I did that when I was around 16 years old, and I came to the belief that the Adventist Church was not the authentic faith passed down from the apostles. I felt that there was a strong disconnect between the Christian faith as practiced in Adventism, as opposed to the apostolic faith handed down through the centuries, which I already knew something about because of my general interest in history, even as a teenager, especially the history of the Middle Ages. And so studying the early church fathers and the medieval scholastics and so on, and then even more recent theologians from the Reformation and post-Reformation period, I came to the firm belief that the true faith of the apostles was to be found elsewhere. And to make a very long story short, through my reading, but also through the experience of the liturgy, which I found when I came to Our Lady of the Atonement Church, there was the experiential knowledge that tied in with the faith that I had read about as it was practiced through history. And also, I came to greatly appreciate this parish's zeal for the faith, because so many of those worshiping there were converts from Protestant churches, and the solid preaching of the founding pastor, which was very much in keeping with the Protestant tradition of solid preaching, as you and I both know.
Homiletics.
It was very nice to be able to have the best of all worlds within the fullness of the Catholic faith.
So you were an unusual 18-year-old.
I suppose. I still had some normal 18-year-old interests.
No doubt. I know movies are one of the things that you really love also.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And yet the Mass in and of itself is a great drama.
That's right. Yes.
Tells the best.
I don't want to take that analogy too far, mm-hmm. but there is certainly an element of drama and mystery in
mm-hmm.
the liturgy, which our medieval forefathers in the faith would have no problem acknowledging.
So when you came to Atonement, had you been to an Episcopal Mass with your dad?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. So I was familiar. I was very familiar with the various expressions of the Book of Common Prayer, which at
mm-hmm.
that time the normative version in the United States was the 1979 Book of Common Prayer in Rites 1 and Rite 2.
Mm-hmm.
So for the benefit of our listeners, Rite 1 is the traditional English language version of the Book of Common Prayer, and Rite 2 is the contemporary English version.
So could you give us an example of some of the language from Rite 1?
Sure. The very first obvious one would be when making the response to the priest's dialogue, "The Lord be with you," instead of saying, "and with your spirit," it would be, "and with thy spirit,"
mm-hmm.
which is actually not the formal way of addressing somebody, but is the intimate form.
Huh.
So you think of thee and thou, of course, in our modern usage of English, we associate that with a more formal
mm-hmm.
Way of speaking. But if you think about it in another way, to use the thee or thou form
mm-hmm.
shows a level of intimacy,
mm-hmm.
like speaking to one's father or
mm-hmm.
a beloved one.
Mm. Which
but,
when so the priest is in
person. Yes, speaking to that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking to somebody as you in that context means either that is the formal, as in addressing one social superior, or
mm-hmm.
addressing somebody in the plural, which is why
mm-hmm.
the priest says to the people, "The Lord be with you," as in
mm-hmm.
with y'all, those who are assembled.
All y'all.
Exactly. Yes.
Right. But the response is, "and with thy spirit," to one particularly.
And indeed, yes.
Yeah.
So that's why, you know, going deeper into the tradition of hieratic English or the
mm-hmm.
English of the prayer book, yes, it is set apart from the everyday speech of the people, but at the same time, when this kind of language becomes second nature, then it becomes apparent why it's so treasured by
mm-hmm.
those who who were brought up almost a dialect.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I grew up Baptist, and the King James Version was what everybody memorized and preached from, and you know, there was a lot of simple people who memorized the King James and really, like, understood it and also kind of prayed in that type of language because the scriptures informed their prayer. So it's kind of fascinating to see that there's even in other Protestant circles a similar kind of prayer language because of the older English scripture version.
That's right. Yes, if you immerse yourself in the language of the King James Bible, for example, mm-hmm. or the Book of Common Prayer, traditional form of English, eventually, especially if you grow up with it, it informs even spontaneous prayer to some
mm-hmm.
degree.
Mm-hmm. So I recall the music program at Atonement being pretty spectacular.
Oh, yes. That also, it helped form me in sacred music.
Mm-hmm.
So at Our Lady of the Atonement, when I worshiped there, there was choir mass every Monday through Friday, which is unbelievable to imagine for any church in the United States, really.
I'm having a hard time wrapping my brain around that. As a choir director, a choir
yes.
mass Monday through Friday, that's intense.
Right. Nevertheless, they're able to do it because every student in their school
mm-hmm.
from first through 12th grade has to participate in a choir program, even if it's a very basic one.
Mm-hmm.
And then they can divide up the different liturgies for the week that
mm-hmm.
way. And besides daily choral mass, these students are also brought up with periodically the singing of the divine office, particularly
mm-hmm.
evening prayer, which in the Anglican tradition is called evensong.
One of my favorite prayer times. The settings
it's
of...
It's quite a...
Go ahead.
Yes, it's quite a rich tradition to inherit, one which those who grow up around evensong, even if they are not practicing Christians, such as in England, where so many of the great cathedrals and collegiate chapels maintain a professional choir for the singing of evensong
mm-hmm.
multiple times a week, it is still an attraction for people to come and attend. It becomes part of the landscape. And although that's not something that is known well in this country, in the United
mm-hmm.
States, I hope with my work in liturgy to eventually be able to develop a community with a routine where evensong is sung on a regular basis
mm-hmm.
and becomes such a fixture that people in that area will just know to wander into church at a certain time and, you know, get to experience that.
We have so many wonderful settings of the Magnificat, Mary's Prayer, and also the Nunc Dimittis, which is Simeon's Prayer, that are part of evensong.
Oh, yes. And since you mentioned that, I'll highlight here that a number of those settings were written by the great composer William Byrd,
mm-hmm.
whose death we observe the 400th anniversary of his death this year.
That's right.
Byrd died in 1623 on the 4th of July, which means that in this country it was impossible to have a proper observance on the actual day of his death. However, I do have a number of commemorations planned through my organization, the Durandus Institute for Sacred Liturgy and Music, which will commemorate Byrd's death in three different cities. So there was a mass on August the 3rd in Washington,
mm-hmm.
D.C. at the Crypt of the National Shrine. And in Philadelphia, there are plans to have an evensong at St. Agatha St. James Church in September, September
mm-hmm.
the 8th, the Nativity of Mary. And finally, on September the 25th, you are if you ask nicely. So we'll come back to that. But yes, and then finally, in New York City on September the 25th, which would be the observance of the Feast of Our Lady of Walsingham, bumped one day from Sunday the 24th.
Mm-hmm.
We will have an evensong, again using the Ordinariate's office, and that will particularly have the great service
mm-hmm.
of William Byrd's arrangement of mm-hmm. Magnificat in Nunc Dimittis.
With a professional choir in an incredible setting, that will be glorious.
Yes. It will be one for the ages. I always have a mind-blowing experience at
mm-hmm.
the Church of St. Vincent Ferrer on the Upper
yeah.
East Side of Manhattan. The architecture there is designed especially for an English Catholic aesthetic
mm-hmm.
with the rood beam. And the
mm-hmm.
long fire saws and the
mm-hmm.
various altarpieces and other design features.
So you mentioned Durandus. Can you tell us a little bit more about what is the Durandus Institute and why a project that focuses on liturgy?
Okay. The Durandus Institute is named after William Durandus, the medieval French bishop who wrote a massive treatise on the symbolism of the liturgy in the Mass and the Divine Office. This
mm-hmm.
was one of the most hand-copied books of the medieval world after the Bible. It was one of the first books printed on the printing press after the printing press was developed in Europe. And to honor Durandus's contribution to liturgy, I gave the name of the institute after him,
mm-hmm.
as well as to highlight what I hope would be the institute's specialty among other liturgical organizations of research and presentation of the historic medieval liturgies of the Western Church, such as the Sarum Rite, which was practiced
mm-hmm.
in England before the Reformation, the Mozarabic Rite in Spain, the Ambrosian Rite in Milan, and the rites of the religious orders, such as the Dominican Rite, the Carmelite Rite, and so on.
So what makes these rites so special? Why highlight them?
The historic rites of the Western Church have much in common with the extraordinary form or the traditional Latin Mass as we know it, which was codified by the Council of Trent or in the aftermath of the Council of Trent in the year 1570 under Pope St. Pius V. However, there's a certain richness to the medieval liturgies, which was perceived by many in the Reformation and Counter-Reformation eras as perhaps overly gilding the lily or being overly exuberant. For example, in the Sarum Rite, in a celebration such as Vespers on great
mm-hmm.
feasts, there would be the four rulers of the choir in their copes and staffs, having the celebrating priest and his assistant since the altar, not only the main altar at Magnificat as we are used to in Vespers now, but also all of the side altars throughout
mm-hmm.
the church, or having processions with not just one processional cross, but three processional crosses,
mm-hmm.
or having the big ostrich bands, or, I could go on forever. Yes. Yes, the inaugural event of the Durandus Institute was a special celebration of Vespers according to the Sarum Rite on Candlemas Eve of 2020, which was shortly before the whole world,
mm-hmm.
Just kind of fell apart.
Mm-hmm.
It was very well received.
Mm-hmm.
Our unofficial count was 700 people in the church. It was, Candlemas Eve is February the 1st, and this was also the day before the Super Bowl. So it was very cold in the church. It was raining outside. But nevertheless, because as people filled in, the church started warming up. I remember when the choir was warming up way before Vespers, singers could see their own breath emitting through their mouths.
Mm-hmm.
But that added a certain kind of authenticity because, of course, you know, in medieval England at the time, the Sarum Rite was at its height. The normal, you know, experience of liturgies like this was in a large stone church with certainly no central heating. In fact, in the medieval English church, it was normal during the cold season at Mass to put a bowl of hot water on the altar so that the priest could dip his fingers in the hot water while celebrating Mass so that he, you know, so that they wouldn't be too numb and he could still offer the holy sacrifice.
Mm. It would have been nice to have something like that for the singers.
Yeah, I'll make a note of that for next time. And there will be a next time.
Wonderful. I look forward to it.
I've just got to make more planning. I mean, that whole event shaved off, you know, probably 3 months of my lifespan.
Yeah, I was going to ask
in the stress of it all.
Absolutely. How much time and effort, even money, like what does it take to put on something like that?
Right. For major liturgies like that, they don't just happen. There is an incredible amount of planning and coordination behind the scenes. And yes, money too. It can be thousands of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And so my institute is always strapped for cash, because, Durandus does so much, pro bono, for the good of the faithful.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm happy to do that, but I always welcome contributions to help my work continue on further.
We will put a link with the show in the show notes so that listeners can go and donate towards that and also know about the upcoming events.
Okay, that would be great. Thank you.
Absolutely. I had a great question for you, and I just forgot it. This morning we were doing something Durandus related.
That's right, yeah. So this is an example of some of the work that the Institute does, besides just putting on grand liturgical celebrations with the greatest music of the Christian tradition. Besides that, there is a lot of work that goes in providing consultation to our priests, deacons, religious, and, you know, lay faithful
mm-hmm.
on how to improve the situation of liturgy and sacred music at the local level, at the parish level.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't just deal with specialty liturgies such as ancient rites, or not just the extraordinary form, not just the ordinariates mass,
right.
But I do as much as I can to help normal people, normal priests with offering the mass, the ordinary form mass, as we sometimes call it, the modern Roman rite, and the liturgy of the hours and devotions as reverently as possible. In continuity with tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, that's right. So Deb, you and I provided consultation at a parish.
Mm-hmm.
I won't name where it is in case Father feels too embarrassed, but it was a great experience.
It really was.
Listening to this holy priest, you know, talk about his journey.
Mm-hmm.
And
his vision.
Where, the parish as he inherited it, and, how much he's done since then and how much more he hopes to do in the future. But you know, the even if a pastor of a parish in the Catholic Church has the final authority, it is still incredibly hard for any priest to do the good work that needs to be done just by himself.
Mm-hmm.
And that is where the guidance of a professional liturgist, a professional musician, and I know a professional liturgist in the current context sounds kind of like a bad word, because that, you know, there are certainly many awful examples of what those could be. But
well, you know, the
nevertheless,
joke is, right? You know the joke
the
about
joke
the liturgist?
Is,
the liturgist and the terrorist?
Oh, of course, yes. But you can repeat it for everybody else.
Well, you can negotiate with the terrorist.
Right, yes. So I can be terribly inflexible about, you know, things that are really important.
I laugh because I
beyond just
as the director of liturgy and music in a parish for 3 years, there were certain things that really were inflexible, but
mm-hmm.
it's not really understood. The nature of the importance of it is not really understood, and so things are treated as flexible even though they're not.
So yes, in the world of liturgy, there are you know, there are things that must be done so that the liturgy is valid, right? So that the sacrament is truly confected, the bread and wine become the true body and blood of Christ. And that's, I think, you know, for most of our listeners, that's obvious. However, there's also another level, of which is things which are licit or illicit in the liturgy, meaning that something that is illicit does not affect the validity of the sacrament.
Mm-hmm.
However, it is against what the church has prescribed for what is becoming in worship.
Mm-hmm.
And part of being a Catholic is acknowledging that we are not the masters of the sacred liturgy,
mm-hmm.
but we are its servants. And that is true even of priests. It is true even of bishops, and it is true even of the Pope.
Mm-hmm. Good reminder. Thank you. That leads me to my next question, which is also, I say it very, very tongue in cheek, but is the ordinariate really Catholic?
Well, I get that question a lot. So I'll give you a serious answer. The serious answer is yes. The ordinariate is Catholic. Now, earlier in this talk, I described the Anglican use pastoral provision under Pope St. John Paul II. So what Deb and I mean when we speak of the ordinariate is that entity or three entities created by Pope Benedict XVI
mm-hmm.
As nationwide dioceses of a sort for former Anglicans to come into the fullness of the Catholic Church while, you know, coming in with their congregations,
mm-hmm.
with their clergy, sometimes keeping the same name
mm-hmm.
of a community, and retaining many of their worship traditions, which were done on an experimental level in the beginning in the 80s with the pastoral provision.
Mm-hmm.
Now the ordinariate was the next step. So, it is common for people to come across the ordinariate on the internet or walk into an ordinariate church by accident, just looking for a place to attend Mass on Sundays and being confused, wondering if the ordinariate is really Catholic or if it's another of the many breakaway groups on the internet which claim the name of Catholic, which will even assert being in full communion with the Pope, the Holy See, but for this or that reason, are not actually. But if you were to open the Catholic Directory in the United States, which is the master book that contains all of the names of all of the different Catholic churches
mm-hmm.
and approved Catholic institutions in the United States, that's including the Eastern Rite churches, you will see the Ordinariate of the Chair of St. Peter, which is the ordinary administering to the United States and Canada,
mm-hmm.
you will see our cathedral and chancery in Houston, Texas. There you will see all of our parishes and other communities, you know, around the country listed there, the names of their priests. And that, you know, appearing in the Catholic directory is one of the signs that lets you know that we are fully part of the Catholic Church. Our priests can celebrate Mass in regular diocesan parishes, or they can come celebrate with the local bishop at the Chrism Mass or any other time that they choose. Regular Catholics who are part of the local diocese and fulfill their Sunday obligation at a Catholic church, they're allowed to make their confessions at our parishes, and so on and so forth. So the short version is that, yes, we are really Catholic. Thanks be to God, to Pope Benedict XVI.
Amen. Isn't that the truth? Thanks be to God, Benedict XVI. Yes, because he really did pave the way. And if you can hear the piano in the background, yes, I am at home tonight. Recording from home and not my office, so there is some of the joys of family life taking place here. I did tell the kids I was recording, but I think they might have forgotten. You know, it's absolutely wonderful that this avenue has been opened up, because so many people have come into the church as a result and continue to be brought into through this evangelistic effort. We have an ordinary parish here in the Philadelphia area, St. John the Baptist. Let's see if we have time. I don't know if we have time for a little history on that or not. Maybe not today. Maybe I'll have Father Keyes on. But maybe if you could tell us a little bit about our new priest and what is going on at St. John the Baptist.
Okay. Well, St. John the Baptist, which is the ordinary parish serving the Philadelphia metropolitan area, we received our new pastor, Father Stan Keyes, in July, and there are preparations for his formal installation by the Bishop of the Ordinariate, Bishop Lopes, that I have been working on for, well, quite some time. But Father Keyes was a former Episcopal priest, and so when he came into the fullness of the Catholic Church through the Ordinariate, he mm-hmm. was approved for holy orders, was ordained a priest, even though he is married with several small children.
Right, he has
this
five.
This will not be.
One. Mm-hmm.
Yes, so this is not our parish's first married priest, but it is our first married priest with small children, which changes the whole dynamic of the parish in an interesting way
mm-hmm.
that we have not had before.
Yes.
So there's a sense of it's kind of a shakeup, which I greatly appreciate. You know, there's a sense of rejuvenation, a new wave of energy, which as somebody who, you know, I help coordinate a lot of volunteers at St. John the Baptist, and I'm trying to frankly exploit as much goodwill as possible and newfound energy that people have, because there's a lot of excitement about what we can do in the future with our small community. Most ordinary parishes, especially outside of Texas, where the early pastoral provision parishes began back in the 80s, but
mm-hmm.
those are, you know, many of those are big, normal sized parishes. But for most of the rest of the United States and Canada, they're very small. And so that means that there are not as many people to, you know, tap for, volunteering. So I do try to be careful to help Father with not burning anybody out, you know, spreading
mm-hmm.
Spreading the volunteer work around.
Mm-hmm.
It's a careful balancing act. But people at St. John the Baptist know that, they can expect me to call on them for help with this or that.
Uh-huh.
on a semi-frequent basis.
Yes, I know that with his wife expecting their sixth, the women in the parish are actively getting together meal trains and all of that to support their family. Both Father and Gretchen have a background in singing and choral music. And so they bring a lot of gifts and appreciation of music and liturgy to the parish. So in addition with, you know, we have a phenomenal organist with Bill Gatens, who's been with the parish for how long, James?
Since the beginning, since before the parish of St. John the Baptist was created, when there were two separate ordinariate communities meeting
right.
in separate churches and separate areas of the metro area, and Bill was serving both of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's an incredible musician and a faithful servant. So it's it really is. It's a parish that is alive and growing. And I had Claire Finnegan on here, the head of our Catechesis of the Good Shepherd program, talking about how we catechize our kids. And so it's lots of families, lots of babies and little ones. What are some of the distinctions of the ordinariate liturgy?
Okay, well, you know, earlier I spoke about the use of the language of the prayer book.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few unique prayers in the ordinariate form of Mass, which are derived from the Book of Common Prayer, that don't have a direct analog with either the ordinary form or the modern Roman Rite or the
mm-hmm.
extraordinary form, the traditional Latin Mass. To give one example, there is the congregational prayer, which is said before communion by those who are about to receive, called the Prayer of Humble Access.
Mm-hmm.
That prayer begins as, "We do not presume to come to this thy table, O merciful Lord, trusting in our own righteousness, but in thy manifold and great mercies." When you hear that kind of language,
mm-hmm.
you know that you're about to enter into something that's very serious.
And
but at
very
the same
special.
Time, at the time that this prayer was written, it was composed by Thomas Cranmer, the
mm-hmm.
Archbishop of Canterbury, who helped orchestrate the split from the Catholic Church into the Church of England.
Mm-hmm.
However, I want to point out something that helps us understand what the ordinariate is about here, just beyond just the text, because the text is very beautiful and it can be read completely in a Catholic sense, but it was written by somebody who we, you know, as faithful Catholics now understand was frankly a bad man. This is somebody who, did something that was, you know, frankly wrong. That's,
mm-hmm.
you know, helping facilitate the separation of the Church of England from
mm-hmm.
Rome,
mm-hmm.
helping facilitate the separation of King Henry VIII from his true wife, Catherine of Aragon.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, what is in the mind of Rome is that you can take something that was done for the wrong reasons, or something that was, you know, done in sin, but you can baptize it, as it were, and graft it mm-hmm. into the fabric of the Catholic Church. And that is
mm-hmm.
the lifeline that Pope Benedict has given to Anglicans who want to be faithful to the gospel, but could no longer practice it, you know, within their churches.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and so now we can pray it within the context of the Catholic Mass. It has become, truly
Indeed.
Become a Catholic prayer. Well, thank you, James. That is hopefully that has given our listeners a little taste of what just the beauty and the glory of the reverence of an ordinary liturgy. And whether it's evensong or mass, check it out and see if there's a parish near you. If you're in the Philadelphia area, St. John the Baptist in Bridgeport have mass at 10 a.m. on Sundays. And Catechesis of the Good Shepherd, levels 1, 2, and 3 available, and they're all phenomenal. If you have not listened to it, check out my interview with Claire Finnegan, and you can learn more about Catechesis of the Good Shepherd through that. Anything else, James, that you wanted to put a plug in for the Durandus Institute before we wrap up?
Okay, well, let's see. Besides those events that I mentioned, we are currently planning to have a Vespers, a solemn Vespers in the extraordinary form at Old St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York City on September the 14th for the Feast of the Exaltation of the Holy Cross.
Yes.
This event also is in conjunction with the first day of the week-long Festival of San Gennaro in the Little Italy district. So it'll be quite a feast
quite festive.
Multiple senses of the word.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, fun.
You can nourish your soul, nourish your body,
mm-hmm.
have a lot of fun.
Oh, that's
and,
cute.
Yes. Even though it may seem irreverent, I promise you it's not, but after one of the several pontifical masses that I've assisted at with a bishop, you know, when a bishop celebrates the mass, you know, in his full regalia, this is mm-hmm. after a pontifical mass in the extraordinary form, you know, he said that he had a lot of fun. It's okay because, you know, liturgy can be fun even though
mm-hmm.
it is done well.
Mm-hmm. You know, we did mention our bishop here, Bishop Lopes. Is he still on the Divine Worship Committee of the USCCB?
Yes, as of now, Bishop Lopes is still the chair of the Committee for Worship for the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops.
Mm-hmm.
And so he helps oversee things like, for example, the upcoming new and more accurate translation of the Liturgy of the Hours, the
mm-hmm.
modern form of the Divine Office, that all priests and deacons and religious are bound to say in one form or another every day. You know, he also helped develop guidelines for parish observances of the you know, after the death of Pope Benedict the 16th. So, you know, St. John the Baptist, we had a solemn Requiem Mass with the help of the Durandus Institute in putting together the Requiem for Five Voices by Cristobal de Morales.
Mm-hmm.
We used some of Bishop Lopes' guidelines in how we would properly mourn the Holy Father after that. So in that role, Bishop Lopes does exercise you know, a considerable amount of influence for good,
mm-hmm.
or you know, not just within the ordinariate, but you know, for the whole Catholic Church throughout the United States.
That's right. That's right. Yes. I wanted to put in a little plug for him also. he's wonderful. Love him. He's such a wonderful bishop.
Mm-hmm.
So for those of you who would like to get a hold of me, counseling-wise, you can do that through 610-601-9781. That's Integrity Counseling Services in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. And thank you all for listening, and I look forward to your feedback. DebRojasCounseling@gmail.com. That's Deb, R-O-J-A-S, counseling@gmail.com. And God bless you, and have a wonderful night. Mary, undoer of knots, pray for us.
You just heard The Tangle Knot with Deb Rojas on the Four Persons Network. Real sound Catholic counseling that helps us to fulfill the greatest commandment, to love God with our whole heart, our whole soul, our whole strength, and, yes, our whole mind. We will see you next week for another wonderful show with Deb Rojas. The Four Persons Inc. is a registered 501c3 nonprofit. All rights reserved. Any unauthorized use of this content without the permission of the Four Persons Inc. and our hosts is prohibited and subject to legal action. Thank you.